Hello and welcome into another edition of New Track Record. Caleb Hatch and Justin Kinney with you. And we got a lot to get to. Not as crazy as last week.
No.
But we still got some good stuff to get to. We have a TV schedule essentially out for IndyCar with the upcoming season. Some interesting choices on the TV times for the races. We have updates on, let's see, some rule changes, some safety. We have some livery reveals. So plenty of things to dive into this week. Plus, we're going to have a fun little feature at the end. So shout out to longtime listener Tony Jennings, who also gave us the hookup for Rich Energy when we couldn't find it previously. So we got to sample it. And then eventually, I think I found it here like at a discount store years ago. But he has sent us the Legends of Indy vintage trading cards. These are from 1992,
yes.
Correct?
Yes.
So we have several packs that he sent us. So first off, thank you. And we're going to open one of these packs.
Just one of these packs, 10 cards.
And just kind of go through and see what we have.
Yes.
In this Legends of Indy, because of course, IndyCar has their trading cards that are out. Looking forward to that. In fact, those start shipping, I think, sometime in March. I've actually ordered a couple of packs of that. So we'll kind of compare and see what we get
with
this.
Yeah, we'll do a live unpacking, I guess.
It's like essentially our own unboxing. I know that's not the right word for this, but that's what we're going to do at the end of the episode.
And it says on the front of this package here.
I love this.
Look for randomly packaged autograph cards by Rick Mears.
Well, and on the back, we could have entered to win a 1992 Indy 500 prize package, right?
Yeah, we're supposed to look for entry form inside the wax pack, which I imagine is like the covering. It also says information provided by IMS and narratives by noted historian Donald Davidson.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll open those towards the end of the podcast.
But we'll start with the TV schedule being released. And what's interesting is there's still one track to be determined. Barber Motorsports Park on April 28th. They did not release a broadcast time. It will be on NBC. So that's the one remaining race. But we look at it and some surprises, some stuff we'd expect. St. Pete broadcast time at 12. They're starting to come out with actual like race schedules for these. And I would assume the green flag would be around 12:30 for that event.
Mm-hmm.
Thermal. This is one that's interesting. 12:30 Eastern for Thermal on March 24th. That means 9:30 local time.
Well, first of all,
I like the move. I think it's unique.
It's fine. First off, I thought opening the IndyCar app, I would have a nice handy spot under schedule to look at all the times. They're all TBD on the app.
Yeah. It's
why do you have an app if you don't update it?
It's not updated. I checked this the other day. I was actually confused. if you go to the story on the app, though, it has the chart,
which is what I had to use before. So let me bring the chart up here because God forbid I go to the app and get information in the car that you yourself posted.
Wait till March 1st. I would think. Remember, they'll do their app update before the season. You have to update the app and then everything's good to go.
Yeah, whatever. I guess they just have part timers. They only work March through August, apparently, or September. Anyway. So we look at the 9:30 local start for Thermal. That's fine.
I actually like this because you're going up against the NCAA tournament in the second round that day. And some of those earlier games are going to be the lesser interest games. And this is a way for IndyCar to stay on the radar because if you have it later in the day, I think you're just completely lost in the shuffle.
As much as people are kind of moaning and groaning about Thermal, the fact that we have a race in between St. Pete and Long Beach is tremendous. It's a win. It may not be the ideal race. It's not a points race, blah, blah, blah. It's not an oval at Homestead or something, for example, one of the races that was kind of thrown around as filling that gap. But hey, it's a race. You may not like it, but there's $1 million up for grabs.
And we'll still watch.
We will still watch. Absolutely.
Long Beach standard time, 3:00, green flag, approximately 3:45. Barber's the one again to be determined. At Indy, the road course race on May 11th, 3:00. These are all broadcast times, not green flag times. Indy 500, again, 11 a.m. Same as always, green flag after, around 12:30 or so. That's been standard since NBC took over. Detroit, noon. I always like the earlier start times on June 2nd, so that'll be a noon start. Road America, this one pushed back in the day. Normally it's been earlier at 3:30 on June 9th. And this one, I think, is really fascinating to me. WeatherTech Raceway Laguna Seca, 6 p.m. Eastern, obviously 3 o'clock Pacific time. Maybe dip in slightly to that primetime time slot on Sunday night. I mean, here's the thing. Yeah. In the summer,
yeah,
for IndyCar, if you're not starting a race at noon, you're getting lost in the shuffle
right.
for a lot of people, especially in the Midwest, between travel and going to the lake and going to the beach and all those things, right? Activities. So I actually like the later start time because I think that could get maybe a better kind of lead in and maybe a better rating. Yes, it's on USA, but I kind of like what they're doing there.
Yeah, my thing is too is like maybe this is a track thing too, or Laguna Seca thinks if we have it later in the day, maybe we can get a slightly bigger crowd. Who knows? But yeah, I'm fine with some evening races in the summer.
And again, the lead in is NASCAR at New Hampshire.
Oh, that's nice.
On USA. So again, these are the things that help IndyCar. So I can't complain. I actually like that move. It's going to be a lot better for fans as opposed to having it, you know, maybe earlier in the day. Not that that's an area that's going to get extremely hot, but this will be interesting having it in June and not at the end of the season. Mid-Ohio, July 7th, 1:30, pretty standard. Iowa will have an 8 Eastern, so 7 Central time for race one. So you'll have some darkness probably at the end, maybe, hopefully. I mean, you got to remember in mid-July in the Midwest, it stays light till, you know, 9:30-ish or so. But I guess out there it'd be about 8:30. So you'll get some darkness, so it'll be kind of a mix. And then race two, noon Eastern, so 11 a.m., that's early.
My thing is, too, is like it just doesn't give you, if you have an accident on Saturday night and you don't want to go to a spare car, or maybe you don't have a spare, that's a pretty quick turnaround.
Yes.
To get that thing fixed.
And then Toronto, 1 o'clock Eastern, the Peacock race, July 21st. That's been the standard time for that for several years. Then you have Gateway, and this is... Yes, it's in theory a night race, 6 Eastern. So that really means 5 Eastern.
No, it's not going to be nighttime.
That's not going to be nighttime.
That's going to be over at 8 o'clock probably at the latest, yeah. And it's still not dark then.
Can we just get a true, like, just start at 8
o'clock?
My thing
is, like, why are you starting at 6? Just start at 7.
Yeah. Now, granted, we know that the with pre-race and all these things, right? I mean,
yeah,
you add at least a half hour. But still, it's kind of an awkward time.
Like, are you trying to be at night or are you trying not to be? Because 6 o'clock isn't close enough to dark.
Yeah.
Unless you just have a crazy amount of cautions.
There, you know, and I'm curious because I'm actually trying to look this up at the moment. Is there an Xfinity lead in, right? Because that's like the only thing I can think as far as,
well, I think
I
think this is a concerted effort by IndyCar. Like, why is it a coveted? You're looking at this, and there's a lot of 6 p.m. starts. Laguna Seca is 6 p.m. You look at Gateway is 6 p.m. Milwaukee 1 is 6 p.m. Like, what's their infatuation with 6 o'clock?
I guess you're getting people are going to eat dinner at the track. I don't know.
Wouldn't 7 be better? It's kind of weird.
Well, and that's Eastern. Remember, local time, we're talking about central time zones for these.
Right.
It's 5 o'clock. It's just awkward.
I'm talking about, like, if it's for TV, 6 o'clock is not a good time. People start sitting down after dinner and all that stuff, maybe turn it on at 7 o'clock. That's kind of weird.
It is odd. Portland on August 25th, remember that moved up. 3 o'clock Eastern, again, makes sense. Milwaukee, we talked about race 1 at 6 Eastern on Peacock. Race 2, September 1st, 2:30 Eastern. And before everyone freaks out, you're not going to draw a crowd because it's, you know, so late in the day, the next day's Labor Day. So you still have that built-in pass.
Yeah.
And then Nashville Super Speedway, 3 Eastern in mid-September, season finale on NBC. I guess, and we already knew, like, the TV broadcast outlets,
but now
right?
You see,
but you look
it
at
on,
it in the lack
like
of
it.
Momentum, right? July, you feel good about. With Mid-Ohio and both Iowa races, then you go from, you know, with NBC, then you go to a Peacock race, and then you're off due to the Olympics. Nothing you can really do about that being on NBC till August 17th. But then USA, USA, Peacock, USA, and then a race on NBC to close it out.
I just feel like you are entering complete irrelevance after the Olympics and even prior to before, because you go USA, USA, Peacock, USA, and then wrapping up the season on week two of the NFL season. Like
the good thing NBC. Is five of the what seven final races are on ovals. So
we've heard about that, how great that is.
That adds a different wrinkle to the championship.
I think when we look at in terms of if IndyCar is going to show another year of growth in terms of viewership, it better get off to a really good start because it has more races on USA. It has an additional race on Peacock. It's going to be next to impossible to have growth from last season to this season in terms of viewership, unless you're just gangbusters the first half of the year.
And that's what they're going to have to hope for with St. Pete and Thermal and then, you know, Barber, IMS, Indy 500. It's tough though, because even that, I mean, you're looking at like 2.5 months between the season opener to the Indy 500. And despite having what, five of those first six on NBC, still it's spread out pretty far.
This is a schedule that to me would, if I'm IndyCar, go, you know what? Let's see what Fox has to say, because six races on USA, two races on Peacock. I know we heard it before, but then when you see it all laid out with the times and all that, it's not great.
And you can't use the excuse of your NBC of the Olympics, because IndyCar shifted their schedule for you due to the Olympics, right? So, I mean, it's not like that's the only reason that's holding up IndyCar from getting more races with NBC.
I think USA is a dead end in terms of sports. Nobody's seeking out USA to go, I wonder what sports are on today. So
they have a lot of sports, but I don't feel like they do a good enough job promoting that. It's not known. That's not their brand.
Right.
And brand is Law and Order reruns.
Yes, pretty much. It's going to be sandwiched in between Law and Order, SVU, IndyCar race, SVU, Law and Order. That's what it's going to be. And meanwhile, if Fox was interested, be like, hey, your races that aren't on network, they're on FS1. And I know a couple of years ago we say, so what? But FS1 is a lot better than USA. So this schedule to me, if I'm an IndyCar official going, yeah, you know, if Fox comes with a better deal than 8 of our, 18 races on USA and Peacock, I'm listening.
And you got to remember, FS1, now I don't know if this is still true, but at one point had more viewers, and this will blow people away, at least our American audience, more viewers as far as in more households in the U.S. than ESPN.
Really?
So, and that I think was true last summer or fall.
Wow.
Going in. So, I mean, that's just kind of, it was by the slimmest of margins, but still.
Sure, but still.
So that's an advantage. So with FS1, you have a known sports channel. NASCAR qualifying got over 1 million on FS1 leading up to Daytona. So there's an audience there to be had. They obviously have a lot of racing programming on FS1 to begin with. So that helps. If there's qualifying or practice, you can always push it to FS2, right? There's just, and along with the app thing and, you know, Fox teaming up with ESPN and Warner Brothers Discovery, which is TBS and TNT, those outlets for a combined streaming kind of super platform, is supposed to launch this fall. So there are a lot of benefits there. And for NBC and CBS, if they are a player, which I haven't really heard that they are, they don't have that luxury of being a part of that group. And so it's just another sign of it pointing toward Fox being what I hope is one of the true contenders for the next TV contract.
Would you say that for the foreseeable future, and I'm saying the next decade, there will never be as many network races on NBC as we saw the last 2 years?
Yeah, there's
no way.
I
think that was kind of like the apex.
Yes.
And now it's starting to trend downward, and this is kind of the first step or second step towards that. I think we saw the apex of what NBC was willing to give IndyCar in terms of network races, and it's just going to shrink from here, in all honesty, because this schedule isn't being impacted by the Olympics. It's not like, oh, we're racing, but we have to be on USA or Peacock because the Olympics. You're off during the Olympics. So that's not impacting the schedule whatsoever. It's just NBC going, you know what? We're going to put more than, 40% of their races now on USA and Peacock?
Yeah, I mean, it's like a 9-8 split, so.
Yeah, but it's almost 50%. So it's just, we knew all this, but man, when you put it on paper, when you put it on a graphic, and you see particularly that latter half of the year where you're trying to drum up interest of a championship race, and all your races are off network until the season finale when you're going up against the NFL in week two on NBC. Like, good luck with that.
Yeah, that's the downside of going to mid-September. Like, if you're going to enter the NFL season, continue a bit deeper in, I guess, than just the first week or week. I think that's week two, right?
Yeah, it's
the
week NFL two. Season. I mean, it's just, I know that inevitably you're going to have that, but it's just, unfortunately, when you're done at Iowa 2 on July 14th, you only have one network race left. And that's 2 months away on September 15th. It's not good.
Now, as far as the Barber race start time, according to Nathan Brown, expected to be a midday start.
Yeah, I wouldn't expect anything crazy. It's not like they're trying to secure temporary lights, you know, to have a night race at Barber.
No.
That would be cool, though. Can we start that movement?
Yeah.
Everybody just like pull up and point your headlights at the track and light it up that way.
Sign me up.
Overall, though, I mean, it's a good schedule, I feel like. In terms of events, it's a good schedule. I have problems with times. The times is 6 o'clock. We talked about that. And, of course, what races are on when. But overall, I mean, you still have that void at the front of the season. And it just seems like that's never really going to be solved. But I think I will defend that IndyCar is incredibly smart by not going any deeper into the fall. I mean, once football starts, it's football season, you know? Once Labor Day comes and you have college football starting, it's football season. And the fact that, I mean, F1's a global series, so that doesn't even count, but you know, NASCAR still tries to do it. Ooh. I'm perfectly content with IndyCar going March to September.
So that's a look at the TV schedule. Again, we'll have more in terms of, you know, an update on Barber and obviously on a race by race basis with green flag times, which are always a fun thing for me. I personally love the 5 minutes of pre-race.
Yes, you do.
Command to start engine super early. Have a couple quick segments and then boom, pace laps. Yes. And then
you would
we're
love
underway.
Nothing more than the intro playing. And then the first shot is pace laps.
Cars rolling out of pit lane.
Okay.
And
you
then
don't even care about the command
like,
or anything. You just go.
Yeah. They cut to like Kevin Lee doing, you know, a quick report on like the pole sitter. And then,
You go through pit
someone
road
else.
Or
yeah.
Something,
yeah.
You know?
Someone else talking about another driver, like a contender who's maybe far back in the pack and maybe one other pit reporter storyline. And then a shot with, you know, Townsend and Hinch and Lee setting up the race, an aerial shot. And then laps. And then you go green like second time by.
Yeah, that's the perfect intro. But then again, you know, here you and I trying to watch Daytona, and they said, 4 o'clock start?
Yeah, it was, 4:40
yeah.
before they went green?
And you're like, why don't they just tell us when the green flag is? Well, because they want you to tune in and watch that pre-race and stuff. So they know exactly what they're doing. But
they
do. Give us green flag times, please.
Well, the NBA All-Star Game, for example, it said 8 p.m. for TV, so I turned it on at 8 p.m. The tip wasn't until 8:40.
Oh God!
So that's why I don't trust start times.
What do you need a 40-minute pregame for an All-Star game?
I don't know. Apparently, in Europe, like they have very specific start times for events.
Really?
Yes. Like it will say on the TV, like the actual start.
They
of the
do
event.
Everything better in Europe.
Seems like it.
Yeah, they're more relaxed.
In America,
over there.
we just get duped.
Yeah, we get duped
all the time.
That's what happens.
So the TV schedule. That's the first bit of news of the week. I think some of the other bit of news, Joseph Newgarden's defensive move that he used to win the Indy 500 last year has been banned, cutting down, you know, into the pit entry area for the line that extends from pit road to the exit of turn four. You have to avoid racing below that again, rightfully so. Newgarden commenting on this, saying this is the right move for the future. Boundaries are meant to be pushed and rules are meant to push back. You should expect to see additional rule changes that will help rein in other driving standards at Indy without removing the ability for drivers to race hard.
So what's the rule? I mean, what's the penalty?
That move is banned. You can't go beyond that
or what?
Line.
That's what I'm saying. Like in the last lap, if this happens again this year and somebody does it, what's the penalty? Are they disqualified?
It should
be. I mean, that's what I'm saying. Like,
yeah.
What's the penalty? Does IndyCar have the cojones as opposed to going, well, we're just going to give them a warning for the first time or the second time? We see that all the time in racing in terms of exceeding track limits, you know, and how many warnings do they get in Formula One before they're actually penalized exceeding track limits? I'm just wondering, is it going to be a hard and fast rule? You do it, you are penalized, or is it?
They're saying it's illegal, but as far as outlining the specific penalty, I don't know.
Which I would hope that
you wouldn't be able to retain your position. At least one would hope.
I would hope. I would hope that if you do it, you are immediately disqualified.
Yes,
but
should be a black flag maneuver.
IndyCar loves to have these rules that they don't really enforce or are inconsistent in enforcing, or it is a penalty or it is a violation of some sort, but they don't know how to penalize it. That's why I'm like, what's the punishment?
You're so negative.
Can we lay that out?
Stop being negative.
Well, no, I'm just saying, like, if it's a violation, what is the penalty for doing it? Okay, it's outlawed. That's fine. I mean, if you really want to outlaw it, you just extend the barrier. You know, that would prevent people from going down there, obviously. But what's the penalty?
It doesn't say.
That's what I would make sure. I would hopefully if IndyCar gets that in writing in the rule book prior to the season starting, because it'd be so IndyCar, it'd be like, that's a violation. We're really not sure how we're going to penalize you. But I agree. I mean, at first you told me this, I thought it was going to be the snake maneuver, but it was actually...
That was already outlawed, right?
Yeah, well...
So...
But, no, it's a rule that should have been a rule, and you thought it was a rule, but now apparently
well,
it is.
It felt like common sense because it's such a high-risk maneuver. But again, no one was in the pits, no one was going to be diving into the pits.
Right.
Because Newgarden was leading the race, but it was a highly dangerous move because you got to remember how close he was to the pit wall attenuator. Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, he swung across at the last second.
Yeah, it was.
That was not part of the natural racing line.
Well, and I thought, isn't there a commitment line that it's like, hey, if you go below this line, you are committed to going into the pits. And he went well below that line. So I would have thought that would have been a rule already, but obviously that wasn't called. I don't know. I mean, yes, it's outlawed. It should be banned. But if somebody does it, and I wouldn't blame somebody in the final couple hundred meters of the Indianapolis 500 trying to win the biggest race in the world, somebody doing it, okay, what's the punishment? Are you going to say that they did not win the Indianapolis 500? I would hope so.
Yeah, I think they have to put a hard and fast line down.
Yes.
They made this rule, but they didn't say what the punishment is. I'm sure it will be detailed. I don't think we'll have an issue with drivers trying this again. It was such a unique circumstance, right, that caused it. Just like the Ross Chastain Hail Melon move in Cup a couple years ago, right?
Yeah.
No one would have dared to try it, but that was a last-ditch effort, and it worked. And just like Newgarden's move was kind of a last-ditch protecting his line move that hadn't been tried before.
And here's the difference between those two is like, Joseph Newgarden's was a dangerous move. You mentioned how close he came to the attenuator. Ross Chastain's move was just wild. Like, I would keep that in the rules. If you want to just beat up the side of your car and go around the edge, like, go ahead. I just kind of thought that was kind of silly that you banned it because it was a pretty damn cool move and it doesn't put anybody at risk. So,
yeah, it just puts the car at risk.
Yeah, beat up your
obvious
own damn
damage.
Car if you want. But no, it was... that's the difference in those rules. I thought it should be something that, hey, if you driver, you want to beat the hell out of your car and go around the wall, fine. But obviously the IndyCar move is more safety related.
And speaking of safety, good segue there.
Oh,
they made some upgrades at IMS for fencing and barriers ahead of the 108th Indy 500 Marshall Pruitt with the details on that on racer.com. The first look at the improvements will be during the Indy Open Test April 10th and 11th. Inside of turn three, 1,700 feet of new catch fence has been installed behind the barrier in addition to the corner.
Okay.
And then the inside of turn four has 800 feet of new safer barriers. Another first time addition to
the
circuit.
On the inside.
Yes.
So prior to the pits.
Yes.
Okay.
And then between turn three and four on the inside of the short chute, 85 feet of guardrail replaced by a new safer barrier section. And also, they have brand new safer foam installed in all pre-existing spots around the oval.
Mm.
So millions of dollars, obviously, to try to do all that. But
are you surprised that they did not raise the level of fencing along pit road? Or actually put a fence?
I mean,
in
they
there
raised
whatsoever.
They raised the pit wall height several years
ago. Well, I'm talking about the outside.
The outside? I mean, they had already redone the fencing for all of that. Like, I don't know, what, 5 years ago or so?
Yeah.
I just don't know. I guess I'm not really surprised.
Yeah. I just think I still think that that's just kind of a disaster waiting to happen with no fencing along the outside of Pitt Road.
But I hope not.
No. But anytime you're adding more safer barriers, that's good for everyone.
We'll get to several livery reveals, a little bit of driver news as well. But first time for you to let us know what you think. You can always find us at newtrackrecordpodcast.com. While you're there, sign up for the email list. You won't miss an episode or any special announcements. You can also check out the store. We have t-shirts and stickers for sale. You can find those on the store page. Also, don't forget on social media, IndyCar Podcast on Instagram, on Twitter/X, on Facebook, just search for New Track Record. And you can also email us newtrackrecordpodcast@gmail.com. Support us via Patreon, patreon.com/newtrackrecord. Thanks to Xavier and others for their support of the podcast. Again, starting at just $1 a month. Thanks to everyone for chipping in on there. And as always, you can download the podcast for free on your favorite podcasting platform, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Overcast, CastBox, Player FM, so on and so forth. So many platforms. Wherever you listen to podcasts, you can probably find us on there. All right, mailbag time. And we actually have a lot to get to this week. So we will start in with what we have. And we go back to some of the things from late last week. This from N.K. Hardner. Remember a few months ago when there were whispers of IndyCar adding a new marquee event to a new market? Cynical side of me thinks they're talking about Lebanon, Tennessee the whole time. Hashtag they got me. I mean, the rumor is, I guess, Denver, but I don't...
Is it Denver over Salt Lake? Are people still mentioning Salt Lake?
I don't know. Denver's the only thing I've seen of
late. Dust off Pikes Peak Raceway and just go at it.
Also, I mentioned this because it was 100 days to the Indy 500, 23 days at the time until the IndyCar season opener, a lot less now. But N.K. Harden also saying, excited to see the new cars with the new hybrid engines and third OEM. Also excited for the new international races. And to cap the season off with cars running down Broadway, that's all still happening, right? Jeremy from HBG said, 21 days until coin drivers are announced at that time, so even less now.
Wow, he thinks they're going to be mentioned 2 days before. That's very confident of him.
Yes, I don't disagree. And let's see.
They didn't do the whole small bottles of milk thing that they usually do, did they?
Not that I know
where
of.
Where they went around the media tour around the state with 100 days left before the 500. They didn't do that this year.
I don't think so. I didn't see it publicized anywhere.
Because you usually see TV stations in Indy and all that stuff, and people, and Doug Bowles getting around the state.
Maybe that will be in May, like on May 1st or something.
But I thought they always did it like the 100 days.
Maybe. I don't remember the exact date.
Yeah, I thought that was always a thing. Maybe I'm mistaken, but somebody let us know. I thought that was a thing.
I thought so too, but I've not seen it to this point. Other notes in the mailbag. People perhaps disagreeing. Stealthwave 1014. Even on a week of positive news, talking about last week, you two find a way to look at everything negatively. You're getting to be unlistenable.
You responded, like, other than the Sato news, what was positive last week?
And they did respond.
They must have been the Oval fan.
They did respond. Fox interest in broadcasting, which, again, that wasn't new news. We just got more details.
Yeah.
We knew they were interested. Another Oval. You subtract away from your...
If it was a new Oval.
Yeah.
But it ain't.
I mean, it's a new Oval in the sense that they haven't raced there since, what, 2008?
Well, I mean, I'm talking about, like, is it
whatever.
A new event?
But yeah. Sato all positive. Yes, we didn't acknowledge that. The Nashville out and back race was awful TV. Few attendees. Obviously, wasn't profitable. I mean, it was a private event. I went the first 2 years.
There were plenty of people there.
Yeah. It was a fun time. It was a unique race, as I think we both said.
Uh-huh.
We don't want every race to be like that. Also said, we know the template for this distant Oval, Iowa, now just execute. But you don't have, and I get it, you have big machines, so it's like obvious you're going to get, musical acts. But it's still not the same event.
Well, no, but...
It's also like Iowa can go across multiple record labels, whereas Big Machine is going to have a focus on obviously Big Machine artists.
You can't just, the texter makes it sound simple that you can get four mega acts.
Yeah.
And the budget to get those mega acts every year. It's like, oh, it's simple. Just get four bands to come and play. It's not that simple. Not that simple. Well, you better have seven figures to pay each of those acts, by the way.
I mean, let's just put it this way. Like, they've had people scheduled for Nashville who couldn't make it, and they were scheduled to play a concert. So, like, I'm looking on the artists on Big Machine and some of the, like, name people. Brantley Gilbert, yeah. Rhett Young, Carly Pierce, Chris Jansen.
Those people came?
No, but these are all, like, these are all possibilities. Daniel Bradbury,
they're with that record label, yeah.
Dolly Parton, Eli Young Band, Florida Georgia Line. Let's see. Justin Moore, Lady A. I mean, there are a lot of people
you
on
land
it. Rascal
two
Flatts.
Of those, that'd be big time.
Sheryl Crow, Thomas Rhett. I mean, yeah, would be massive. Mm-hmm. Cadillac 3, Tim McGraw, which I did see him in Nashville one of the years. But you'll be lucky to get four high level acts. You'll probably get two.
It's too simple saying, well, look what Iowa's doing, and you just do that everywhere else. No, it's that's much more difficult than what you're making it sound.
You posted this as far as, you know, Motorsport said more oval tracks are a good thing for IndyCar. Agree or disagree? You said yes, but only if people, you know, show up, which is critical. Mom 2X over 2002 saying, for instance, at Texas Motor Speedway, IndyCar could get Pato Ward to do Spanish language commercials, play in the Rio Grande Valley, San Antonio, and Austin areas. They also try to partner with HEB, Whataburger for the race. And saying that it goes back to IndyCar promotion with tracks, Penske, the tracks themselves promoting races like at Texas.
Which I think is more
better way with promoting across the state for IndyCar.
Right. But that's more on the tracks.
Yeah.
I mean, the tracks have to do a better job promoting their events.
But IndyCar has to give them incentive and make out a friendly contract to make it work for them to do that.
Yes.
I am analog saying the closest track to me is New Hampshire. I would spend as much as I could there if they race there again. Which, again, there's a gap in the Northeast, right?
Uh-huh. Just don't try to restart the race in the rain. Avoid that.
But then you'd get a classic willpower moment. So, I mean, there were positives
that
for
that.
That
is true. It was all a big ploy to get a rise out of willpower. And it worked.
Yeah. It did work. You posted this poll. I thought it was interesting. What's the next race you will watch? Cup in Atlanta this weekend. On February 25th, as we record this evening of February 22nd, nearly 27%. F1 in Bahrain, which is March 3rd, nearly 23%. And then IndyCar at St. Pete on March 10th, 50.5% of you said IndyCar. I voted F1. I know I'm not watching Cup at Atlanta because Cup at Atlanta is awful every year.
It is bad. I am surprised that more... I'm not surprised with the IndyCar running away with it. I'm surprised that more people are going to watch Cup than Formula One, at least in terms of their next race. Yeah. Maybe they're just people that like watching Cup. Every year it's the same when I watch Daytona, and maybe not as much this year, but I'm always like, all right, maybe I'm gonna try to make a concerted effort to watch more Cup.
Not when Atlanta's race two. It's not worth it.
Well, not even this year. Like, last couple of years, I'd be like, yeah, I'll tape Atlanta, and then wherever they go after this, is it Phoenix or Homestead or whatever? And then once I get like three races in, I'm like, all right, this is terrible. But not even this year. I don't even have an incentive whatsoever to try to keep watching Cup. I don't know why. I thought it was a decent, typical Daytona 500, but have zero interest.
Less chicanery than I expected.
Yeah, until Ross Chastain went.
Yeah.
Took Austin Cindric.
But you knew there would be
end.
A big crash at the end, and there was a sizable crash at the beginning, but other than that, it was a lot of green flag running, which was actually nice to
yeah,
see.
Well, I thought Austin Cindric, I texted you, and I think literally 10 seconds after I sent the text, he gets taken out.
Yes.
And
I agree with you, though. I think I said, yep, that's my pick, and then boom.
Yeah, I gave him the kiss of death. I thought he was going to win it. He was in prime position, but unfortunately, other drivers were not so accommodating.
Why even bother? The W actually two Vs. All three plus WEC and IMSA. Run underscore Mark Run said, when you live in Buffalo, you catch every race in the winter, just need to see sun and cars on track. That is fair.
So other places are indeed getting snow because we're not here.
Yeah, it's kind of terrifying if you think about it. Jeremy from HBG said, I didn't realize Daytona was this past weekend until it got delayed. I am analog. F1 is so boring to watch. I just listened to a podcast and that's the extent of my interest. And Vicky Lynn 26 said, too late to vote, but definitely IndyCar at St. Pete. So what we'd expect, half IndyCar. And then
it's going to split the
rest of the way, which again, a lot of people sending their thoughts on the start times. Bauer Racing, nice to know all the start times of every race, but the one I'm attending, Barber, Tyler_Allen. I like the number of 12 and 1 p.m. races. There aren't night or West Coast. I think they did a good job with that. Pochevchenko, having every oval doubleheader be under the lights is good. Looks great on TV. Comfortable for drivers and fans. Vicky Lynn 26 pointing out no time listed for Barber and Thermal at 9 a.m. Pacific time. Very odd. Again, that's the stuff you can try with a exhibition type event.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's not going to be a lot of people at that thermal event, so you're not like, oh my gosh, we have to accommodate 20, 25,000 people to get to the racetrack and all that stuff. It's kind of, hey, it's going to be a small time event, but we still want to be in that 12 to 1 p.m. window on TV, so it makes sense to me.
I love that move. I love Laguna Seca at 6 p.m. Eastern.
Yeah, me too.
Outstanding on a Sunday.
I would like more evening races on Sundays.
Especially if it's going to be out on the West Coast where it works for that audience, but on the East Coast, it works for a better TV rating.
Yeah.
And they're going to have a cup lead in. I mean, I think that's perfect. CJ9 said, is Thermal really going to be a morning race? Yes, CJ, it will be. It is wild.
The 400 people there aren't going to mind that it's 9:30.
No, they're not.
And all of us watching are going to be very thankful it's a 12:30 race.
And then we got this from Patrick_Stankus. Coyne may not have his drivers announced, but the rebrand on Transporters is done. So a picture from the Coyne shop in suburban Chicago.
So
also pointed out, Rick Ware Racing doesn't mention Coyne on their team bio.
I thought that was interesting.
Yes. Not a big surprise, but it is interesting.
So are we... at least for this season, of the belief that Rick Ware Racing is not involved in any car whatsoever?
They'll not be, nor will HMD. They split with Dale Coyne at the end of last season, and we'll get more on what they plan to do moving forward here in a bit. But as always, you can always tweet us, email us, send us a Facebook message, Instagram message, snail mail. You can send us messages there. That is how you get in touch with us on the podcast. And appreciate all the entries. Didn't even get to all of them because there are so many this week. All right. Time for news and notes. And we actually have plenty to get to in this category as well. So let's start with that Coyne news. So again, they split. HMD split with Coyne. We still have no update on Coyne. We thought we'd get some progress. The rumor is that it's going to be like split entries in the cars, like an oval driver and a road and street course driver, I think, for both entries is the latest I've been seeing out there. But for HMD, they're going to run their 10 entries in lights. And that's it for this upcoming season. Now, long term, they still want to be an IndyCar. But they said until the dollars and cents make sense for us, it's hard for us to make that jump. And so this year, no affiliation with any team, no partnership.
Okay.
Now, as far as a one-off partnership for this year's Indy 500, which has been kind of rumored out there. Also no one-off for the Indy 500, according to their team manager.
Which I think is fine.
So
probably smart.
Yeah, it just comes down. And remember, they're going to move into their new shop in Brownsburg, which is outside of Indy, 65,000 square foot shop. They're going to start moving into there at the end of this month, and they want to be fully moved in by the end of March. So they have that on their mind, and that's going to be their focus, is getting set up in their new digs, and then who knows, maybe in 2025 there will be a team. Does it feel like, and I get that they're not partners anymore, but like, is there a point where they buy the assets of a team that, you know, is taking a step back? Is that how that works for them to enter the sport?
Whether
it's Coyne, whether it's Juncos, Foyt, I'm just naming teams that are on the... not that they're on bad financial footing.
Right.
But obviously not in the level of a Penske, an Andretti, a Ganassi, McLaren, a Ray Hall.
Right.
Even, you know, Ed Carpenter, you know, like, it seems to be more realistic that they buy the assets of a team
yeah,
right now with how things stand than them getting all new equipment and entering. One, because you have a maxed out entry list outside the Indy 500,
right,
in terms of regular full-time entries.
Yeah, I think it's smart. HMD could very well just quickly go through it and jump into the series, and then it go south and then fall apart. I think they're biding their time, and quite frankly, why rush it at this point? And I could see them, especially with Coyne's struggles. I mean, it's a running joke, you know, TBA, haha, go Coyne. But like behind the scenes, it just shows the instability of that team to have enough money. Effectively, every time this happens, it means they have no budget to run a car until the 11th hour. Like, that's not a way to run a business. That's not a way to run a race team. So behind all like the chuckles and we get a kick out of it is real struggles at Coyne to make ends meet. And at some point, could that mean another additional investor buying the team? And could that be like an HMD? Wouldn't be completely shocked.
Now, as far as they're open to exploring partnerships, according to the article in motorsport.com, but they're looking for a collaboration or a partnership. They're open to that discussion. And in fact, they've discussed with a couple programs already, but they're not in position to sponsor a driver. Also saying they don't have a program that can go out and find sponsors yet. So again, obviously they want to be in IndyCar, but they're taking a methodical approach, and I don't think anyone can blame them because we've seen it work out negatively, right? When you go all in too quick.
Yes. Time and time again, that's not very good.
All right. Let's run through several livery announcements. So, Andretti set to announce their liveries, unfortunately, after we record on February 24th. So we'll have that to talk about next episode. Pietro Fittipaldi, the 5-hour energy car for Ray Hall. That'll be for the Indy 500 in Detroit. And as Marshall Pruitt pointed out, a lot of Scott Sharp vibes for this entry in the Delphi car. Remember that back in the day?
Oh, yeah.
With Kelly Racing. And I don't know, Pietro Fittipaldi's livery for the 500 in Detroit, this might be my favorite one on the
really?
Grid.
It's pretty sharp.
I am a fan.
Are you a fan of 5-hour energy? Have you ever had one?
I don't think I've ever had one.
I don't think I've ever had one either. My dad likes them in terms of if he's making extended trips, he's like, it doesn't make me too jittery and keeps me up and stuff, but I don't think I've ever had one.
I don't think I've tried one. Which
me neither. Maybe they'll just be throwing them free ones out.
Well, I'm sure.
The thousands.
I mean, they're free Red Bulls usually when I'm like walking in the 500 outside turn four, so get those most years. The Hy-Vee Honda, black and red, similar colors, but I think it looks really, really sharp for Christian Lundgaard, the 45 car, that one unveiled. You have Alex Palou in the DHL 10 car, which is just weird, but again, looks good. You have Stingray Robb's car, also black, red, and yellow for Foyt, which that seems to be the vibe, right?
Yeah.
For all these entries.
Seems like it.
As far as livery unveilings, and then you have a couple partner news, DNS Filter with Hunkos, which they've been with Romain Grosjean in the past, so that one makes a lot of sense as well. And then a couple other announcements. You have Callum Ilott, who tested at Homestead with Arrow McLaren, and filling in for David Malukas as far as a hybrid test on the Roval at Homestead earlier this week. We'll see about who that replacement driver is. I know it comes down to is WEC's schedule and making it work with all the moving pieces there.
Yeah, we'll see. But I mean, we had heard even before all this that McLaren was kind of high on Callum Ilott, and it just seems like a natural thing to work out, particularly at least in terms of testing and being in the seat. So could we see him the first couple races, do you think? I mean, if you had to put a percentage on it, what would you say percentage chance that Callum Ilott's in the seat at St. Pete? I'm kind of like 70-80%.
Yeah,
right now.
Pretty high. I know the schedule and the turnaround is a little tough for WEC as far as where it stands, but there's a way to make it work. I mean, it's Qatar on March 2nd, so the next race isn't until April, but it also depends on the testing program for that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if I were to make a guess, that's still my guess, and it's been my guess from the get-go.
And the longer we go without hearing of somebody else, you make it think that it's Callum Ilott, right?
Yeah. Elsewhere, IndyCar tracks getting some repaves. This is from Marshall Pruitt. You have St. Pete, Detroit in some areas, and then a full repave for Mid-Ohio. So that'll be good news for that track, getting a full. So you had Road America and Laguna Seca last year. Now St. Pete, or not St. Pete, Mid-Ohio for this year, getting a full repave among permanent road courses in IndyCar.
Very nice.
You have Alex Palou, who will compete in the 24 Hours of Le Mans with Chip Ganassi Racing. So congrats to him on getting that opportunity. And then, do you want to go bad news for Honda or good news for Honda?
Let's get the bad news out of the way.
Okay,
first.
Well, the bad news was a nugget that Marshall Pruitt had in the racer.com mailbag this week. And this note that Honda is seriously considering whether it wants to continue after its contract is completed in 2026. Means IndyCar, if it wants to keep Honda, needs to work with Honda Racing Corporation US to address its concerns on costs and supply responsibilities to ensure HRC US stays. Obviously, that's concerning. We all know this.
And he basically said without any significant changes, they're going to be gone. And do you think it's a concern that we haven't heard anything about IndyCar reaching out to Honda? Do we think maybe they have and just we're not hearing about it? Or do you think really that there has been no dialogue whatsoever since that became public? I'd like to give IndyCar the benefit of the doubt, but it's tough for me.
It's hard to say because like we're also not in race season, so they're not like whining and dining these executives.
Yeah, but you would think if you reach a, if you read a story like that, wouldn't you be picking up the phone and be like, "Yeah, we got to talk about this ASAP." I mean, it just seems like one of your top partners.
I mean, in theory, you've already had discussions with this partner, and it's just that it finally leaked to the public.
But it sounded like, too, that IndyCar was had its ego hurt because Honda went public with their opinions.
Well, when it's clearly, like, behind the scenes, if
it wasn't working, right?
Yeah, so, if Honda hadn't said anything behind the scenes to IndyCar about it first, yeah, that's bad on Honda.
But all indications were they had already made their
intentions
known, or concerns known at the very least. And I don't know if IndyCar just didn't take him seriously or what. And now maybe if it would not surprise me with this leadership group to be like, oh, you know, Honda did that, so we're just not going to talk to him. You know, we'll show them. We're not going to give them the time of day. Like, it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, I think good business practice would be you have a major partner that's threatening to leave. You'd want to appease that partner and have it as much dialogue as possible to try to rectify the situation. I just don't have much confidence in this ownership group doing that.
And let's get to the good news then. And that's the fact that Takuma Sato will have a role with Honda Racing Company US. He has been named an ambassador for the brand. And again, you take the good with the bad, right?
Yep. Yeah. Two sides of every coin. Right?
Executive advisor.
Okay.
So I think this tells me two things. One, he's very much nearing the end of his IndyCar career, as we all mm-hmm. know. It wouldn't shock me if this is potentially even his last. Who knows?
Yeah.
But also, two, that he'll have some say in with executives, and that's only going to help IndyCar in that aspect.
I would agree.
And then
what
time
else we got?
Tweets of the week. So we'll get to that real quick. There's just one from Scott McLaughlin. So it's a two-parter. So first he tweeted, surely everyone agrees if you go barefoot on the plane, you should be on the no-fly list.
Mm-hmm.
And then he followed that up by saying, guy next to me has dropped the flip-flops and rolling barefoot like it's home. It's just gross.
Gross. Like, what is wrong with people?
I don't know. That should not be a thing.
and two, like, wouldn't you not want to wear flip-flops on a plane with the dirty floor and all that stuff? Like, I wouldn't
one
want to
would
wear
think.
Open-ended shoes. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
People are odd.
So, it's time.
Let's
open
us up
our pack. Thanks to Tony for sending these 1992 Indy trading cards. So a vintage pack.
Yep. 10
we're going to take a look. So we're doing the,
nicely as possible.
Yeah.
Here.
You're being very careful.
Yeah, whatever. I'm just going to tear it.
Okay. Now, you can hear the tears in the background. Great sound effects. Get it right by the mic.
Ooh. So we can get, this is something in the back. We can get a Legends of Indy trading card binder. Binders are available for the 1991 Premier Edition and the 1992 Edition binder. Only $9.95 per binder with this mail-in coupon plus $2.50 shipping and handling. So
I don't think that address is going to work.
We should send something in here. If you missed out on last year's premiere edition of Legends of Indy.
What if we missed out 30 years ago?
Let's see. MasterCard, Visa, money order, checks accepted. Allow 4 to 6 weeks for delivery. This is a $10 off coupon too, Caleb.
Ooh.
For just $14.95 plus $3.50 shipping and handling, we can get last year's premiere edition of Legends of Indy.
Okay.
I'm going to hold on to this.
All right.
Okay, we also have here, here's the entry form. Win the all-expense-paid trip for two to the 1992 Indianapolis 500. Persons under 18 must have parental approval. Entry form must be received prior to May 4th, 1992.
We're a little late.
Drawing to be held on May 6th, 1992. Good luck. Okay. So we got those out of the way. Now we're going to look at these cards. All right. So.
Thank you for holding the edges.
Yes. Well, yeah. I've been around the block a time or two. So here we have Legends of Indy. So these are I imagine these are 1991 results.
Alan Unser Jr. Yeah, well, that's a 1991 shot, it says.
Yes, but did he finish fourth in the 500 in 91? And then on the back, what it does is it gives his details of the race. So I imagine he started fifth, or is that his number?
Just the number five card of
maybe
the
set? It could be, potentially.
Do the cards have like a unique, like a still fresh smell? Like, is there like a...
Smells old.
Okay. I didn't know.
But I mean, back then it could have still smelled old. In 1991, his prize money was $223,916 for finishing fourth.
Okay.
He got $223,000. So his starting position was sixth and he finished fourth. Two laps down.
Okay. Can you imagine that now?
And people talk. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Okay. We have, this is going to set the tone too for our random Twitter driver of the week. With Scott Brayton.
Okay.
Finished 17th in 1991.
From what? An hour or so, just over an hour up the road in Coldwater, Michigan from where we're at in Fort Wayne.
And so they have his details of his 500, started 19th that year, finished 17th, completed 146 laps, eventually retired due to an engine issue. Okay. Ooh. Then we get into the Legends of Indy with the front drive Novis here.
The Novi.
So we look at the Novi and gives it a very detailed description on the Novi on the back, talking about the V8 supercharged Novi racing cards. Oh, we have to see card number 989 of the Premier Edition for more details. Maybe we have this later in the back.
That's how they get you to buy more.
That's how they get you. Goes through the history of the Novis, and pretty cool. Pretty cool card there. All right. Then we got Buddy Lazier. Okay. He finished... 33rd that year in 1991, the lap one accident, started 23rd. So there's Buddy Lazier.
Buddy Lazier?
Lazier, as some people say, you know, and his brother, Jacques Lazier.
I've not heard that one before. Jacques?
Here's an 80s pace car, the 1987 pace car.
When it wasn't all Chevy products.
Correct. It was the Chrysler LeBaron.
Ooh.
It was Chrysler's first appearance as a pace car by brand name since 1963. And let's see, front wheel drive LeBaron was driven by Carroll Shelby, shared the winning Aston Martin in the 1959 Le Mans 24 Hours race, and of course came up with the Shelby Moby Mustangs. He drove the 1987 pace car. The 87 pace car, the Chrysler LeBaron. Okay. Oh, we just have a general card here about pit stops.
Oh, fun.
Okay, so that's what we got here. And gives you details about pit stops at least 6 or 7 times during the running of a modern 500. The leaders will have to make pit stops to take on fuel prior to reaching the finish.
Does it mention a time? Because back then, pit stops were a lot longer, correct? Because now it's like 7 seconds.
Well, yeah.
Like 7, 8 seconds. But back then...
We had 40-gallon tanks in those things. So it says... full racing speeds will last them about 32 or 33 laps of fuel. Here he goes. Yes, you're right. A top crew can refuel a car, change 4 wheels, provide the driver with a quick drink, and even make some minor aerodynamic adjustments all in about 16 seconds.
Yeah. Now they do it in less than half.
Yes.
For a good pit stop.
Uh-huh. And it says, as pictured here, there's a real scramble to get back onto the track.
So, and I don't think they had a pit lane speed back then, or if they did, it was pretty new.
Yeah. This is a classic moment in Sneva's Dilemma. Talking about Tom Sneva in the 1983 500. and it talks about the late race caution that came to an end. Al Unser leading by a couple of car lengths over Tom Sneva, and behind Sneva was Al Jr., and that was kind of the dilemma that he was in. And he was able to get by little Al, who was multiple laps down too, by the way. But then he was able to get past Al Sr. for the lead and eventually won the race by 11 seconds.
And I'm trying to remember. So from reading Al Unser Jr.'s book, there were, I can't remember if it's that race in particular that little Al was talking about how people were, you know, accusing him of essentially blocking for his dad.
Yeah.
And it was like, no, I was just running along. Like I was trying to stay out of the way.
It even says on this card, he said he quickly allowed his father to repass, but then spent the next several laps making it extremely difficult for Sneva to get around. And then finally on lap 191, Sneva outfoxed little Al as they were lapping slower traffic and was able to get past him to take the, to get past him and then track down Al Sr. to take the lead.
I mean, what else was he supposed to do?
Yeah, what else was he supposed to do? Also, a general card about the yellow flag.
Oh, fun.
Interesting. So, yeah, just talking about the yellow flag. Blah, blah, blah. Pace car normally laps at about 85 miles an hour on cautions. No real riveting thing in there.
You know what I like with the pace car? How someone always has their, like, hand out the window.
Yeah.
Right?
Aren't they just giving people fives? Isn't that what
that's what it looks like. But I'm sure there's, like, an actual meaning for that.
Probably.
It's like it's some sort of hand signal.
Okay, we have two to go. We have the illustrious front row here. The 1991
Wait, two to go, so that's
row.
Time to go from red to green.
Yes. Yes. We're going full rich here.
Yeah.
With two to go.
Forget another caution lap. We're just straight to green.
Yes, that's what we're doing. See, this is a card for the 1991 Indianapolis 500, the illustrious front row.
Ah, in does which not you had get any better.
Mears, Foyt, and Mario. So the three combined for an unbelievable 74 total 500 starts, and that was the front row of the 91 500.
And it's not just that it's the three iconic names. It's the three iconic cars. It's Mears in the Penske Marlboro Chevron. It's Foyt in the black Copenhagen.
Yep.
And then it's Mario in the Newman Haas, you know, Texaco Haviland entry. I mean, it's just the iconic cars as well.
Yes,
for all three,
which is pretty
that
cool.
I think of when I think of them. And I get that that was the end of Foyt's career, but just an iconic picture, an iconic moment.
Yep. So great picture of those three. And then our final picture, no autograph Rick Mears card in this pack.
Not in this pack.
But we're going with the Legends of Indy, the 1911 lineup.
Ooh.
So pictured is the scene a few minutes before the pace lap of the very first Indianapolis 500. And what may very well have been the first mass rolling start for any automobile race anywhere in the world.
Correct me if I'm wrong. That's not a row of three in that picture, though.
That is a row of five.
Yeah.
The hell is going on here?
One looks like a pace car, doesn't it? Or kind of separate?
I can't tell.
Like on the far
difference.
Inside, that car just seems kind
of
out
of alignment.
Yeah, it
doesn't have a number on it. You're right, because the middle one, they're all numbered on the front of the grill. 1, 2, 3, 4. So that must be a pace car. But it also says it may also have marked the first use of a pace car, since races at the time almost universally employed standing starts. Because, you know, they just did lights out back then, right?
No, they would probably have like a gun go off, then you'd run to your car.
Yeah, that's true, because that was safe.
Like at Le Mans.
Oh, you're right. So here we go. On the right of the picture is the Stoddard Dayton pace car to be driven by Carl Fisher. I'm thinking it's the left.
Well.
Oh, yeah. It's the, okay. Left, right, okay. I'm trying to read things different. So, yes, it is the pace car driven by Carl Fisher, who conceived the idea of the Speedway. Note that there are four cars next to him. Look, it's like we wrote this. But five in the subsequent rows. Four abreast starts were used from 1913 until the current three abreast start was introduced in 1921.
Huh.
Interesting.
Interesting. Now, remember, we also have 40 cars for that first Indy 500?
Well, you know, it's tradition to have 33. It's always been 33. No, not so fast, folks.
Not 1997. It was 35.
So there's our 10-pack plus our entry form to be entered into winning two tickets to the Indianapolis 500 for 1992. And I need to send this to make sure I get my 1992 edition binder.
Yes.
To put my cards in.
And also explore the premiere pack. So
yes.
We have several other packs. We're not going to like open one every episode, mind you.
No.
But we just wanted to kind of give a rundown, see what it is. Thanks to Tony for sending these. And obviously, when the IndyCar trading cards come in, and I ordered a couple packs, we'll for sure do a giveaway for one that I don't think we'll get them in time for St. Pete. So we'll probably save a giveaway for the Indy 500.
Yeah, I'll purchase a couple packs too. We'll have some stuff. And as we get closer, we're going to have to fire up our fantasy.
Yes.
IndyCar.
Man, we're so close. Like, next week's the end of February. And then, correct me if I'm wrong, it will be race week. In two weeks from now, it will be race week. It's wild.
Yes. We're getting there. I mean, this week, we had Daytona. Then we have another week of just Cup only. Next week, we get Formula One. And I know some people moan and groan, but I'll still have it on. And then after the fact, I'll complain about how Max Verstappen ran away with it. But I'm looking forward to that. And then the week after, we're at St. Pete.
It's come up on us so fast. Every year, you know, you may have like one or two weeks where you feel like there's a lull in the off season, but this off season, it's really only been maybe one or two weeks total since last September.
It's the off season that has kept on giving. For sure.
For better or for worse. It's time to wrap it up with our random split error driver of the week.
Well, we mentioned Scott Brayton, of course, lost his life tragically. And we're also going to go with another driver that lost his life in the random split error driver of the week. And this is one I forget too, when we think about fatalities in open wheel, in kart and IndyCar, and even after the split and then the reformation.
Which today, actually, quickly interject, today is the 16th anniversary of Champ Car and the IRL reunifying.
It doesn't feel that long, doesn't it?
No.
It doesn't feel that long. But prior to the merger in 1999, this 1999 kart season, we're going to talk about Gonzalo Rodriguez, and was a driver from Uruguay. It was his second appearance for Team Penske. He had earlier raced in that season at Detroit, had finished 12th, and then at Laguna Seca towards the end of the season during a practice session, fatally injured in a crash with a stuck throttle, overshot the breaking point, left the track, striking a tire barrier, slamming into a concrete wall behind the barrier at the entry of the corkscrew. The impact caused his car to flip over the barrier, land upside down on the other side of the wall. He was killed instantly by the impact with the wall, and which was lined by only a thin layer of tires. Because of the incident, an additional tire wall was installed at the end of the straight. He actually had a contract. I didn't know this. He had a contract in place to compete in the 2000 kart championship with Patrick Racing. So prior to that 1999 season, he spent 3 years in Formula 3000 and raced in there, and did some British Formula 3000 and did some Spanish Formula, some Renault Racing, all that stuff. And but of course, in just his second race in kart, was killed at Laguna Seca.
And a guy who had a ton of promise, and it's just it's crazy kind of how history plays out, because Elio then moved over and he was going to be out of a ride, right? Mm-hmm. And then Penske called, and Elio got the opportunity. Little Al moved on from Penske after that season. It had just kind of been a disaster as far as their chassis goes. And Little Al had raced with, I think, two different chassis. The Penske chassis just was not working that season.
Yeah.
Tarso Marquez raced a handful of races. Gonzalo Rodriguez raced, was in two events. Alex Baron was in a couple events. But
this was a dude that had won in Formula 3000, had won at Spa, at the Nürburgring, and at Monaco, had won races. I mean, this dude was an accomplished racer in the junior formulas in Europe and was coming over here. And unfortunately, his career and life ended early.
There's a Spanish language documentary of his life, Gonchi, which was released back in 2014.
Which was his nickname, right? Gonchi?
Yes. And again, a very, very talented driver. I can replay that crash in my head.
Really?
And it's awful.
It's not, it's
truly awful.
It's a helpless feeling, like a stuck throttle. Like, nothing he can do.
And that's a situation where, because of crashes like that, we got the Hans device, and obviously we think that could have been the thing that potentially saved him. But the Uruguayan driver, and we haven't had too many Uruguayan drivers in IndyCar, but very talented, obviously taken from us way too soon. And that kart season, I mean, you had what Greg Moore at the end of the season as well, right? At Fontana.
Yeah, it was a tough year, but you look at what could have been, because you mentioned, you know, few Uruguayan
and Greg
drivers.
Moore was set to go to Penske.
That's right.
So it went from being Greg Moore to then Elio getting that seat. So just to bring it full circle, unfortunately.
I mean, you look at how big having Brazilian drivers like Senna that really jump started the popularity of open wheel racing in Brazil. And you saw what that led to with guys like Tony Kanaan and Elio and stuff. Like, what could have been with Gonzalo Rodriguez for Uruguay? Because he was a ultra talented dude that if he could have really performed for Penske and then Patrick Racing and maybe made his way back up to Penske, who knows how that could have jump started the racing in Uruguay, but unfortunately didn't work out that way.
Yeah. And it went from, you know, Ganchi having a chance and then the unfortunate death, and then Greg Moore set to go to Penske on a contract. And, you know, everyone says, you know, how many Indy 500s would he have won, right, with Penske, especially as they are switching back over to Indy.
Yeah.
You know, not long after that, just a couple of years later, and him dying at Fontana in 99. And, you know, a lot of talk about CART itself and their failure. And there's a lot of blame, right, with the Texas race in 2001. But how much was it the end of the 99 season and just kind of those shocking events happening, and a young up-and-coming driver, and then a true star that was going to break out and probably be a household name the following season driving for Penske, and those things happening and really kind of changing the trajectory of CART.
Yeah.
Again, then, easy to blame Texas in 2001
for sure,
canceling that event, but perhaps that was maybe more of a moment for CART than we think about.
Yeah. I mean, I think it definitely impacted it. Maybe not as much as some of the other reasons, but definitely impacted it negatively. But it was a trying season with fatalities in 99, and you know, they were supposed to race. Remember, the Hawaiian Super Prix was supposed to be that year. They didn't do that. But they did race at Surfers that year. But it was this tough year all around, 1999 CART season. So Ganchi Rodriguez, Gonzalo, our random split error driver of the week this week.
And interesting note, that was the first return to Laguna Seca. Sorry, that was the first series CART crash at Laguna Seca since the series first came there in 1983. So it was, and initially the stuck throttle, Mercedes kind of deflected blame from that, saying it was not caused by that. But that's what they eventually found, right?
Right. Yeah.
But the initial report, reading the story on it, they were kind of denying the stuck throttle issue.
But evidence pointed to exactly that. And it was a Mercedes-Benz engine, like you said.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
All right. Well, unfortunately, but I mean, he was a very talented driver. And you know, it's good. We joke about kind of the random split error drivers, but, and this one may be less random because he died racing. But
I don't think a lot of people remember him or know it. I mean, people, even if you're not, you think, oh, Greg Moore was a big deal in that same year, but it was just a couple of events before that Gonzalo Rodriguez was killed, and he had every bit of potential as a Uruguayan driver as Greg Moore did coming from his discipline. So it's tough, tough year.
Absolutely. Hopefully we'll be back next week.
I'll try to cheer you up.
Yeah.
Next
more,
week.
More positivity, but always good to mix it up with the random split error driver of the week. And that will do it for Justin Kinney. I'm Caleb Hatch. Next week, we'll be on the cusp of the IndyCar season. Hopefully Dale Coyne Racing will have us
maybe
news.
We'll have a driver news, and we'll give you an update on my entry to win tickets to the 1992 Indianapolis 500.
That's still to come. Thanks for joining us on New Track Record Podcast.
Podcasts by Federated Media.